Hi there, and welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. Today, we're talking through critiques of the public sphere with Francis Cody and fake news busting with Govindraj Ethiraj. I'm your host, Ian Cook. What happens to news once it's written? Okay, of course you might answer, it's read. But what else? What new life does it take on? I'm thinking that as we interpret news, we give it a new spin. And this spin might penetrate further and deeper than the original piece of news or a particular journalist's take on it. Or it might amplify or muffle certain aspects of a story. How do these mediations of the media feed back into the production of original news? What are the political ramifications of this? Those who create myths or fake news that riff off news stories certainly believe in the power of such media production and modification. We should all maybe start thinking it through a bit more carefully. I mean, does it matter to us who shares or reframes the news, their characteristics, their background? We're going to explore these questions in two ways in this edition of Online Gods. First up, we're going to give the idea of the public sphere a thorough critiquing with this week's academic, Francis Cody, before speaking with this week's online god, Govindraj Ethiraj, a financial journalist turned mythbuster who runs a number of projects in India aimed at combating untrue news. Those of you who regularly listen will know that this podcast is part of the Project for Digital Dignity, run out of LMU in Munich and headed up by Sahana Udupur. And as of this episode, Online Gods is proud to say that it's an official podcast collaborator of the American Anthropological Association, who, as it happens, have their 117th annual meeting in California in November. Now, we're not on episode 117 of the podcast, at least not yet, but we are up to episode 10, which is a great milestone for us. We would be up to 12, but we took a summer break to recharge our batteries, and in my case, go internet cold turkey and swim in the Black Sea. We're really excited to be back again, however, and we've got loads of really great guests and topics coming up in the months ahead. Let's get on with the show. When I was an undergraduate student in Liverpool, I used to have a housemate who read newspapers while giving us all a running commentary. Someone would bring home a paper and we'd be reading different sections, drinking cups of milky tea in our stained sofas in our dingy living room, and I could never get through a long article without being disrupted by my housemate commenting on whatever piqued his interest or what he had an opinion on, which, being a socially and politically aware argumentative fellow, was quite a lot. It meant that whenever it was my turn on that section of the newspaper, I'd already been given the highlights and so found myself sort of skipping the article unless I really wanted to argue with him, which sometimes I did, and then I would check through it to see whether what he was really saying was true. And this came to mind when reading the work of Francis Cody, whose ethnographic research in Tamil Nadu, which is a state in South India, explores, among other things, the political ramifications and societal implications of media circulation through and by different groups. Frank is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Asian Institute at the University of Toronto, and broadly his work deals with language and politics, as well as producing critical theories of mass mediation. And we're really happy to have him on Online Gods. Hi Frank, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let's dive straight into a question, I suppose, that we've been like mulling around for a while on the podcast, and that's the idea of the public sphere. And maybe we use it a little bit too freely, a bit too easily on the podcast as a bit of a shorthand, but we know it's much more complex in reality. In sort of mainstream liberal understandings of the public sphere, it's either implicitly or explicitly suggested that the public sphere is a place where strangers meet to interact with one another. Now, thinking through your research on the Tamil printed press, can we say that it's true? Is the public sphere a place where strangers interact?
Well, I think it's important to just start with sort of the recognition of the importance of the stranger and the role the figure of the stranger has played in modern sociological thought. And it comes with a bunch of ethical values that have to do with shedding predefined identities. In fact, it's the basis of a lot of modern political thought. Someone even claimed that democracy or even politics more broadly is only possible to the degrees that we can shed sort of predefined identities, or that our identities do not predetermine our choices. And so you can see sort of the ethical weight that strangerhood has in conceptions of political modernity. So I think one of the interesting things that happens when you start doing empirical research on something like the public sphere, and you think through these idealized forms in the context of research, interesting questions arise, at least for me, about what strangerhood is. What is it in concrete terms? Does it mean that we're perfectly faceless? Well, that's a very rare sort of context of encounter. Generally, there are signs as to who people are when you encounter them. Where I did my first research in a relatively small village in the south of India, in Tamil Nadu, I spent a lot of time at the tea shop where people would read newspapers and discuss politics. And here it struck me that here's a context that in some respects looks like an ideal public sphere. You have, you know, rational debate about politics and so forth around a written text that tell you the news and sort of illuminate aspects of government. But everyone knew each other. Everyone addressed each other as kin. Everyone was an uncle or a brother. It was a very male space. And so it struck me that strangerhood doesn't, you know, really characterize this particular manifestation of what nevertheless could be conceived of as a public sphere. So it raised interesting questions for me more broadly about what strangerhood means. At the tea shop itself, it doesn't mean that persuasion did not work, that people wouldn't change their minds as a result of a debate, or that this was some sort of pre-political tradition at all. But I think it raised for me the question of how we might think about strangerhood in a more finessed fashion, or sort of what aspects of identity are salient at which point in time of one's interaction with the so-called public sphere.
Yeah, super interesting. I guess anyone who's familiar in the Indian context, no matter what parts of India, are very used to these situations where, you know, people gather and sit and talk about stuff outside. Like in myself, I was doing research in a neighboring state in Karnataka, and it's with rickshaw drivers, you know, sitting there really, right, really debating stuff, you know, really getting used to stuff. And I want to kind of push you a little bit there, Nate. So there's strangers there, and they're not strangers there, they know each other, but are they reading texts which are meant to be consumed by strangers? Is there something which is like an issue there?
Well, it's about sort of the phenomenon of mass mediation, right? And for me, that also raised questions about, okay, what about the personalities that people are reading about, say the political personalities? Mm-hmm. Are they approached as strangers? Not at all. I mean, they're approached as intimates. I mean, I was just at the funeral of one of the greatest leaders in Tamil politics of the 20th century. And what struck me is how intimate this funeral of hundreds of thousands of people was. So even people who are experienced as perhaps distanced, mass-mediated figures are related to it in a very sort of intimate fashion. And so there's this, you know, it sort of blurs the boundary between kin and stranger in that respect.
One of the other aspects, which is very much about sort of away from this sort of abstract idea of people debating in the public sphere, is the idea of the crowd or the mob, you know, like a large group of people who somehow are around in debates because, you know, we read about them. And again, maybe one of the mainstream understandings of the public sphere is that there's a distinction between, you know, your rational debater, whether that be in a saloon or a tea shop or a rickshaw stand and so on, and the crowd or the mob on the other. And this distinction has been there for a very long time in how we think about, you know, the public sphere. I was wondering, can you like problematize this a little bit for us? What, if any, is the relationship between, you know, the reader and the crowd?
Once again, we have to approach these as kind of figures of thought that have been, you know, very important, not only in sort of everyday thinking, but of course, at a sort of a higher philosophical level about what's the role of different forms of social interactions in coming to decisions and so forth. One of the essays that really struck me when I was beginning to do research in this domain was one by a sociologist who was Durkheim's contemporary, Gabriel Dettel, and who's recently become more well-known as a result of people rereading him in various contexts. But he wrote a very interesting essay where he precisely distinguished between what he called the public and the crowd. And for him, the distinction was really not based on reason so much, but it's connected to reason. The distinction was about a reading public, that is to say people who are connected to each other through written texts but who would never actually meet. This is something, the sort of the relatively disembodied reader that is looks more like Benedict Anderson's vision of a newspaper reader in his book Imagined Communities, which is, of course, connected to a broader ideology of reason, important to thinkers like Jürgen Habermas. But it's really the distinction between people who don't meet face-to-face and therefore relate to each other as strangers and people who are in crowds and who are sort of energized by each other's sort of physical proximity. That's a distinction that Gabriel Zetal makes in his essay, The Public and the Crowd. Once again, we need to ask in these contexts how it is that reading or reason define themselves in relationship to other activities or other modes of thinking, right? And it's usually through a sort of inverted image of itself. In the case of reason, the crowd is a sort of intimate other that it must externalize. And even, you know, reason must be vigilant against crowd behavior and even agitated about it. So it's something that is very close, that must be sort of shut out from its vision of itself. Now, one of the ways in which I started to approach this topic actually was a phrase in Taleb's essay where he noted that in some contexts, readers might become crowds. That is to say, people who are very agitated or upset about what they're reading might well take to the streets for various reasons. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting sort of place to look at empirically, to think about the relationship between sort of reasonable reading publics and so-called irrational crowds. So I wrote an essay about the limits of liberal reason in interpreting sort of crowd actions, and specifically looking at the market logic of attacks on newspaper offices that might connect reading publics and crowds. So I was interested in attacks on newspaper offices in South India, in Tamil Nadu, that were actually motivated by written articles. So when is it that people become so agitated about something that was written that they turn violent? So readers can get violent, of course, but the flip side is also true in the sense that violence produces a readership. And one of the things that one can note is that crowd violence produces a lot of the stuff of news, and readers are very interested in crowds and sometimes reading about themselves. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of dialectic of mutual recognition that both blurs the lines between crowds at an empirical level, while at the same time, you know, showing how important the distinction remains for liberal ideologies of democracy. And I think it's that kind of tension between the empirical and the theoretical that is, you know, most exciting about the kind of ethnographic and historical work on publics that I've been reading and I'm trying to do in a very new media environment, right, where the sort of relationship between publics and crowds is even more fluid as a result of social media.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was reminded when I read the essay that you referred to, and I'll put links to all of your work on the website, of a time when I was interviewing some right-wing vigilantes in South India, and I met them in the afternoon, and I went to their offices. It was Valentine's Day, and they'd spent their morning burning Valentine's Day cards outside a girls' college, and the afternoon they were sitting looking at themselves in the media, like, hey, how did you look there? How did you look there? Etc.
Exactly.
And so on.
Yeah.
It's like, they're, you know, instant, like nowadays it's instant, right?
Yes.
But yeah, so I think you provide like these really interesting critiques of maybe a Western or liberal idea of the public sphere. I was wondering, when we discuss the media and circulation today, especially in this, you know, highly digitally mediated world, should we just maybe discard this concept of the public sphere completely and try to come up with a new concept? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to think about sort of theories of mass publicities that have come out of this kind of discourse on the public sphere. I mean, one of the things, if you know, the phrase often goes back to the philosopher Jürgen Habermas, and one of the things that he always noted is that it acts both as a normative ideal, while also he wanted to sort of ground it in a specific historical condition, right? So it has both this kind of descriptive and proscriptive element. And I think it's important to sort of realize what's motivating the ideal, right? Instead of just sort of getting rid of it and saying that the empirical reality doesn't live up to this ideal. But rather sort of interrogating the ideal of a public sphere based upon our researches about how media and forms of collective interaction that are enabled by media technologies play into our experience and our production of, I mean, for me, I'm still sort of invested in the question of popular sovereignty and democracy. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like it's an idea that we have to constantly criticize without jettisoning altogether. is my stance on this at the moment.
Thank you. As a final question that we ask to all of our guests on the podcast, it's about the concept of digital dignity, which is a concept that we've been thinking through as part of a wider project, thinking it through in terms of what it might mean to discuss politics, religion, and belonging online. So thinking with your work on the media and on publics, do you think it's possible to have a dignified discussion online, and what might digital dignity mean to you?
Well, it's one of these aspects of online discussion that has drawn a lot of our attention. Is one of the things is that the strangerhood, or the sort of faceless element of a lot of online discussion, seems precisely, paradoxically for some, to be what encourages acts of aggravated violence, trolling, etc. Right? It's because there are no sort of immediate repercussions to the person who's engaged in that act of violence. And so here we have kind of a form of strangerhood. Once again, this is something that we need to ask, sort of decompose. What does strangerhood mean? But a particular aspect of strangerhood seems precisely what enables forms of aggression that would otherwise be socially sanctioned, right? And so once again, this raises very new questions about what strangerhood means in an online atmosphere, which is clearly different than sitting at home reading a newspaper or sitting at a tea shop reading a newspaper. But I think it also raises questions about, like, what are the social types that are subject to persuasion, or what are the other forms in which people engage politically? The flip side of that for me is, what other models of dignity do we have available as an ethical standard that are different from what we might think of as the forms of dignified rational discussion associated with liberalism? Because surely there are other ways in which we can have dignified interactions that are not reducible to the strictures of liberal political thought. And that for me remains a very open question. But it does seem to be a possibility that is held out by some of the more interesting uses of online discussion fora.
Thank you so much for this answer, and for all of us, it's been a real pleasure having you on Online Gods today.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Frank. I think it's really fascinating how in all his work he is careful to understand how news is embodied, how people with all our complex, interwoven, contradictory and changing characteristics affect the way news is discussed, circulated and even produced, whether that be through tea stall chats or through large mob actions. Sahana, the podcast co-host and all-round media anthropology star, she's had some really interesting work on Hindu nationalism that relates to this. She argues, as far as I understand it, that digital abuse cultures redefine the boundaries between mobs, crowds and publics because they use quite a different set of disembodied actions. I'll put a link to her article that she deals with this on the site, and I also know from conversations with her at the start of summer that she's looking into the element of fun which is involved in such online mob actions. You know, how fun becomes a sort of meta practice that links with the logics of spreadable digital media. I mean, it's so easy to spread, to allow the sort of online abuse to become distance and infused with a certain type of deniability. This is something I think that becomes extremely important when we're dealing with myths or fake news. The problem nowadays, as we all know, is there are a lot of different ways in which we consume news, and the question is what is true, or even if anyone is searching for the truth, whether the truth matters anymore, becomes very muddied, especially if mobs online deliberately spread untruths. And there are people who care about this a lot, and one of them is Govindraj Ethiraj, a financial journalist and founder of Ping Digital Broadcast, who has also previously worked for Bloomberg UTV, CNBC TV18, and he's currently the anchor of Policy Watch on Rajyasabha TV. But we wanted to speak to him because he also set up Indiaspend.com, FactChecker.in, and BoomLive.in, websites that seek to offer clarity on stories in the news by checking data or claims, exposing fake news, and also busting myths. And we're really happy to have Govindraj on the podcast. Hi, Govindraj. Thanks so much for coming on Online Gods.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on.
It's wonderful. Let's start with a very sort of blunt question. Why do we need websites like BoomLive or FactChecker? Can't we just have better journalists?
Ian, thank you, first of all, for giving us the opportunity, in addition to having me on your show. I think that's a very important question. Why does mainstream or mainline journalism or mainstream media not touch this broad space of fake news and misinformation? So you have to look at it like this. Now, mainstream media is not built structurally to attack this problem. The way mainstream media works is, and if you ask any colleague of yours from who works for a newspaper or a broadcast station, or if I ask one of my friends, they will tell you that if they come across a piece of misinformation or likely fake news, they will check it out. It's not that they don't check it out. They will check it out, they will explore it, and they will make calls. The conclusion typically would be, let's say, if the conclusion is that it's false or fake, their job ends there. They do not publish something saying that we checked this out and we found it to be fake or false. And that's where the critical difference is. Because a lot of the stuff that you see today is actually flowing under the radar, is subterranean. It's moves on platforms like WhatsApp, where the communication is peer-to-peer or peer to hundreds of peers, and there's no way someone outside can see the way a representative from a mainstream or a media organization can either see it or authenticate it. So there's a structural conflict here, which is why mainstream media will not touch most of the stuff that we typically call fake news. So let me give you an example. A message on WhatsApp could say that a certain person has been accused of committing a crime, right? So now, and that message maybe has, in our understanding, spread to 100 people. It may have spread to 1 million people. We don't know. So mainstream media is actually quite right in maybe investigating that piece of information or misinformation and then concluding that it's not true, and therefore not writing a story on that or broadcasting it to its subscribers or readers or viewers, as the case might be. The way we function is that we believe that obviously this information, now that it is out in public domain, or at least our understanding of public domain, and has acquired a certain degree of virality, needs to be responded to, and therefore we publish it. So that's where the fundamental difference is between the way people like us work and mainstream media works. I know it's a very long answer, but I think
it clears it up. And then so let's talking then about the, I mean, I'm in quite a few WhatsApp groups in India from the city where I used to live, and you see stuff that gets, you know, shared or created very quickly. And I always wondered to myself, and I guess you must also wonder this, like, why do you think people create fake news?
So, the way we've mapped it, there are two or three kinds of fake news. So there is the broadly the advertent, as there's the inadvertent. Now, the inadvertent is me sending Ian a message saying, Ian, did you know that the bank that both of us used to have an account in is facing a $1 billion hole in its accounts because of loans that have gone bad? And Govind tells Ian that I think it's a good idea, or it would be a good idea, to shut your accounts and move your savings to another bank. Mm-hmm. Now, Ian forwards this to maybe 10 people, who in turn forwarded to 20, and in a week's time, you've hit 1 million recipients. That's one kind, right? So, but your intention in some ways was noble. Your intention was to warn a friend or a set of friends that about something that you believe is wrong or likely to go wrong, and therefore you've acted in a certain way. It does eventually, of course, become fake news. The other is where there are people who manufacture content and specifically target it towards either willing recipients or non-willing recipients with a design to either create some sort of communal tension, or it could be, as we are seeing in occasional cases, with an intent to affect the market credibility of a product or service. So these are really two different kinds. And we obviously try and fight both.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you think then social media platforms like WhatsApp and so on, are they messing up our democracies?
See, that's a very good question, and that's something that we're all grappling with. I look at it a little differently. You know, if you look at the genesis of platforms and technology-driven platforms like Facebook, YouTube, WhatsApp, mm-hmm. or the Google internet itself, the whole evolution is about a decade old. You know, mm-hmm. it's only about 11 years ago that YouTube was born, the iPhone was born, WhatsApp came in a couple of years later, Twitter came in a couple of years later, Facebook happened 1 or 2 years before that. So all broadly, the entire inception to evolution is really about a decade or a decade plus a few years old. Now, in the early part of the evolution, we've seen really the benefits, right? This is the period you saw friends connecting with each other for the first time. Suddenly you found a friend who you never knew for the last 25 years sitting or working in some other part of the world. School friends came together, college mates united, people with interests came together who never knew that they could. And basically, I mean, you saw all the positives of networks and platform-based networks. What we are seeing now is really the evil that such networks can also foster. And obviously the people who are on it, or some of the people who are on it, realizing that this is what networks can be used for, or technology platforms, networks driven by technology platforms can be used for. So I think if you see it like that, it's more human nature, which has realized that something can be exploited for a certain objective, and which is beginning to do now. So now, are the platforms to blame for this? Possibly, because they've not been ready for this. But I wouldn't hold them entirely responsible, because it's not platforms which write the misinformation or generate the misinformation. They only distribute it without any publishing, without any editing. Now, to that extent, are platforms supposed to edit everything that is written on their platform? I mean, it depends who you ask, and the technologists will obviously argue that platforms are neutral. I mean, if you look at Wikipedia as an example, Wikipedia does not in itself do any kind of content creation. It only sets the rules, and the content of a Wikipedia page is really driven by how different people from different points of view build an opposing or proposing argument around something. So I think if we look at from an evolution point of view, I think we've reached a point where a lot of the good has been discovered and put to good use in terms of networking people, including in WhatsApp in India, where there's a lot of utility that's driven by WhatsApp. There's no two ways about it. Remember, mm-hmm. WhatsApp has 230 million subscribers in India. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing now is the flip side of it, which is the evil, which obviously a lot of us have been unprepared for. The technology platforms for sure have been unprepared for it. But even law enforcement, regulation, government, media, we've all been unprepared for it. And to that extent, I guess we're all trying to get our arms around the larger problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I suppose one more thing which is a little bit different, or a lot different now than 10 years ago, is just the sheer amount of material which is shared at any one time. So how do you, for your websites, how do you choose, you know, which story that you want to check the facts of? Because obviously you can't do every story that's out there just because there's so many.
Right. So what we do is obviously pick up stuff that we feel has acquired a certain degree of momentum and reach, and pick that up. And in most cases, what we do is typically in our very, very rough estimation or guesstimation has already touched millions of readers, mm-hmm. or users, as the case may be. And that's when we would debunk it. Or we would also look at stuff which is, you know, endorsed or retweeted by, let's say, well-known personalities. Could be in the political arena, but it could also be outside that. So that, because that clearly has given it some, even if that original rumor or misinformation has not acquired much currency, but because someone well-known, a celebrity or a political figure has endorsed it or retweeted it on Twitter, then it's obviously the whole thing has acquired a certain degree of legitimacy and therefore must be questioned.
I have a feeling you probably have a certain challenge as well, which any sort of media has a challenge in India, in terms of language. I get a feeling that a lot of like the sharing on WhatsApp and so on, I'm in groups in Karnataka, a lot of it's in Kannada or sometimes in Tulu, like one of the local languages, and I guess it's passing between WhatsApp groups, changing languages, sometimes in Hindi, sometimes in English, but very often in lots of regional languages. Like, yeah. Do you have any way of dealing with this, or just because you're basically a national-based organization, you just have to work in English, and that's the way it is?
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's a good question again. So what we are doing is, for instance, in the Karnataka elections that happened in May this year, mm-hmm. and we partnered with Facebook to do a debunking project. Huh. We worked with someone who speaks Kannada and could read Kannada in Karnataka, or rather in Bangalore specifically. And the way we've seen it developing is that it really doesn't matter beyond a point what original language it was, because as the piece of new disinformation or information keeps growing in virality, then usually it becomes language agnostic. Mm-hmm. By, you know, so for instance, if some, I mean, these are very wild figures, but if, say, let's say something is written in a certain language in India, okay, not Hindi, because Hindi is widely spoken in any case. So in the first 200,000 or 100,000, 200,000 people read it in that language. The next 500,000 to 1,000,000, my sense is it would have got translated or converted to another language. Or more languages, and the next million, assuming it still retains that character of virality, it would go into Hindi or even English. And by the time it's acquired mass following status, it's very likely that it would surely be in Hindi and maybe even in English, and which is where we would pick it up. Now, going forward, as we get more granular and fine-tuned in our approach, we have to for sure track what's originating in these languages, because the one thing that that I didn't talk about is time, because we don't know. I mean, in an ideal situation, we should be tracking something and countering it when it's still close to its inception point, rather than the point where it's acquired mass momentum. So, which means that we have to track it in the language that it is created, or one of the languages that it's created, and counter it as early as possible in that language itself, as well as maybe a couple of other mainstream languages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that Facebook partnered with you during the elections. So this was an initiative on their side or your side, like to try and solve the problem of the spreading of untruths, or how did this come about?
Yeah, it was along those lines. I mean, we had been talking to them since last year, last August or September, around this time last year. And somewhere in the early part of this year, it emerged that we could work together on a pilot project involving fact-checking a provincial election, in this case Karnataka, or ahead of the provincial election, where, like I said, we would, in addition to what we would do usually, we would also track the local language media or the local language social media, so that we were more plugged into what was happening and therefore we could respond faster. Facebook works with third-party fact-checkers in other parts of the world also. So this was really an extension of that program into India.
And you mentioned that, of course, time is very important. I mean, essentially, you're a reactive balance to fake news or untrue stories which start to circulate. Apart from what you do on your website, which is to check facts, can you imagine any other ways in which a sort of circulation of untruths can be combated?
Right. So the one thing we do, for instance, and quite actively, though not as actively as we would like to, because we are fairly resource constrained, is what we call the fact files. So fake news busting is, as you said, it's a reactive process. Something comes out, you react, you either use tools to verify if an image has been doctored or some figures have been manipulated or a video has been, dissected and re-edited. So and finally, you call up people and you do the journalism part. So that's the part that is that we continue to do. The other part is to say that, okay, how do we respond to an issue that we feel is bubbling up, mm-hmm. right? So an issue that could be bubbling up is, let's say, I'm trying to think of something global right now. So it could be to do with an election that's happening in some other part of the world. It could be to do with Donald Trump's next visit or Putin's visit to America. And people speculating that there's some deal that has been signed and so on. So we do a fact file which says that the five, I mean, I'm not saying that we use listicles all the time, but, mm-hmm. Here are the five things that we know for sure about Putin's proposed visit to America, you know. So that, in some ways, what happens is that that takes away the opportunity to create fake news around that theme. Mm-hmm. And it could be, and that's one example which is sort of global and so on. And it could be very specific. It could be to do with a political leader in India. It could be to do with health. We've done fact files on Zika virus. We've done fact files on other disease conditions because there's a lot of rumors around diseases, contagious diseases like Zika in India. And the whole idea behind fact file is that you're anticipating something that is likely to come up. And when it comes up, people look at this and then they, okay, here is a factual kind of position on this, whatever, the virus or the people or the likely chance of who could be affected or the medicines that you need to respond to it and so on.
So I wonder, are there some people on the other side who are unhappy with your work? Because you must, you know, people who've intentionally created, you know, falsehoods, if they see their myth busted, they must be pretty angry with what you do.
Oh, of course they are. And we get our fair share of trolls and people who believe we are batting for an opposing party, political party, or depend. And sometimes we have the opposing political party accusing of us of batting for the other side because we debunk something against them. That we've accepted as part of life. I mean, I think we have to focus on following our processes, sticking to our independent approach to journalism, to making sure that no bias creeps in, and making sure that we are sticking to our true mission of improving the quality of public discourse and making and ensuring that misinformation and falsehoods do not creep into our daily diet of news or information.
I mean, it's often said that those on the right of the political spectrum, both in America and also in India, have a better use of social media than people on the left. Yeah. You know, and part of it, people say, is because they're just so fast at creating this sort of stuff. You know, that like, and it may be people who are on the other side of the political spectrum say because they care less about the, you know, the truth, you know, the whatever that is. I'm so wondering, do you see more stuff from one side, or is it, you know, more falsehood spread on one side, or is it evenly balanced?
It's a tough one to answer. I mean, I know what the answer is, but I'm a little apprehensive about answering it because it depends on, you know, there may be times when it may all be looking to emanate from one side. And there may be times when both are balanced. And there may be times when the other side is, let's say the other side is more prolific. I think if I look at the overall numbers, I would say that there are organizations who are affiliated with BJP. And I say affiliated with because I don't think it's the party itself which does it. Organizations or individuals are affiliated with the BJP who seem to be creating more or pumping out more misinformation. Now, I have no way of saying it whether they are really affiliated with the BJP. Is it like a counterintelligence kind of strike by the opposition? I don't know. But if I going by the content, a lot of it is against, it would be definitely, I think that there would be a slight majority in the amount of content which is targeted against the non-BJP parties in India.
Yeah, I mean, again, you gave a very nice and balanced answer. I appreciate in your position because of your websites, exactly, you need to remain neutral. So, yeah, apologies for making you feel uncomfortable.
No. not at all. I mean, like I said, we go by what we see, and it's like any news organization. What you report is depends on the material that you find for the day. And on some days, you may find misinformation or fake news that's hitting on one direction, and the next day you may find another direction. But it's tough to say. I mean, it's a question of proportion, right? So if there are if the ruling party has so many people aligned to it, it obviously means that it has much more distribution and reach and network capability than the opposition, which is clearly much smaller today. And therefore, I'm sure limited in its network distribution capability. So,
Thanks for that. And what's your personal motivation for doing this sort of work?
So my interest in the broad space began about 6 years ago when I founded India Spend. And India Spend is about using data to tell stories in public interest, and we focus on issues like health, education, environment, and gender, mm-hmm. with the larger mission or objective of improving the quality of public discourse. So the whole idea is that how do we use data to make a stronger argument, where particularly where emotion tends to get in the way, or emotion tends to drive decisions entirely. Mm-hmm. In 2014, we started factchecker.in, which was basically about fact-checking people or institutions in public life, and very similar to PolitiFact in the US. Mm-hmm. In 2016, it became clear that there was another genre of information or misinformation emerging, which later, if I remember correctly, became to be termed fake news. Mm-hmm. The term fake news didn't, I'm not sure, originated at that time. I mean, I think when people started looking back a little bit, they said, okay, this is the fake news phenomenon. And obviously, Donald Trump used the word quite many times and it became popular. So that's when I realized that we have an opportunity to do something that's a little different and aggressive. Because in Fact Checker, we are really fact-checking people who are known, who are out there, who have reputations to protect, who can be accessed, who would respond to comments and so on, like it does in the case of PolitiFact and organizations like that. With Boom, like I said, you're in the beginning, you're dealing with a whole bunch of information which is subterranean. Yep. It's not even in mainstream media. Mainstream media, even if it sees it, is rejecting it or not reporting on it for reasons we discussed, and therefore needs a slightly different approach and a far more, and a little more aggressive approach rather than very, very careful and thought through fact checking.
Thank you so much, Govind Raj, for this answer and for all your other answers. It's been really great to have you on the podcast today. I hope you all enjoyed listening to Govind Raj as much as I did talking to him. I found it really interesting how he categorized the different types of untruths, how organizations like his are working with media platforms, and of course the zeal with which he defends the idea of the truth. And the truth is a notion which I think we're going to be arguing over a lot in coming years. Anyway, that is it for us this month. Thanks again for listening and subscribing and for all your kind words. We hope you listen again next month. Ta-ra! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahan Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.